Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
Let's cross to Israel to chat to Professor Bill Kohlbrenner. A recent opinion piece, a letter to the free speech hypocrites, has reignited debate over whether commitment to free speech is being applied consistently. The article argues that many individuals and institutions passionately defend free expression when it aligns with their own views, but support censorship or deplatforming when confronted by opinions they oppose. Yeah, you don't need to tell me about this. To help us explore these questions, we are joined by Professor Bill Kohlbrenner. He is a professor of English at Bar-Ilan University, executive director of Writing on the Wall. A very good morning. How was your fast yesterday?
Good morning, Howard. It was okay, and I'm feeling consoled, especially now that I'm speaking to you.
All right, well, there we go. Yeah, I don't get that often, so I appreciate it. Okay, let's talk about this, because generally we hear about free speech, or certainly I hear about free speech, when it is something being said that I don't like. People say, well, this is all about free speech, but of course, somebody who's been deplatformed or cancelled because of my view, I find that a little difficult to stomach. Take me through where we are at today in 2026.
Well, you know, I'm going to actually go back a little bit, rewind. When I started, I'm a professor at Bar-Ilan. I was at Columbia. I did my PhD. And the first article I wrote was about the great poet John Milton, mm-hmm. who people know because he authored the poem Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. But he also wrote a very famous tract against censorship called Areopagitica. That was the first article I ever wrote. And it deals with many of the issues that you just brought up. And he writes about how in 1644, even in the absence of the king, the parliament had introduced this kind of pre-publication censorship. And at the time, you know, this was just ancient history. And now I'm kind of living it. The story is actually personal, personal for me, because the original document produced by PEN America, it was a radical piece for them that documented the silent moratorium on Israelis. Mm, mm. And the president of that organization, Dinot Mengistu, decided that not to resign, not because he was horrified and acknowledging his own complicity, his implication of his organization in this, but because he could not bear that his organization had reported upon Israeli silence. And in an argument in LitHub, he provides this extremely complicated argument, which basically amounts to, we must protect the boycotters. This long study of over 30 authors, poets, essayists, novelists, all of this was just part of a legal strategy so Jews could go into court and argue against BDS boycotts. I, if it's complicated, Howard, I asked Claude to explain it to me, like I'm 8 years old. And it's the kind of rhetoric, and I'll go back to John Milton, who in Paradise Lost, he creates his Satan. Satan is not the Satan of fire and brimstone. Satan is the manipulator of language. He is the origin of Orwellian doublespeak. And that's when I read this prose.
I mean, it could have been written today. That could have been written for today.
I'll read just a passage from Mengistu. While its new boycott policy is perhaps one of the clearest expressive demonstrations of its tolerance for restricting speech when it comes to Israel, if you're not following, I'm also kind of with you. It continues, however, there is also a decade of silence around anti-BDS legislation that the organization has tried repeatedly to defend through a similar twist of logic and language. It's a kind of, I dare you, basically, to call me out. A similar twist of logic and language. We just read five lines of twisty logic and language. But this is the strategy. Everything which we would accuse them of, they accuse us of. Everything, all of literature is deployed against the Jews. He ends with a passage from Toni Morrison, And he talks about how language, this is Morrison, her Nobel address speech. Oppressive language does more than represent violence. It is violence. In his argument, the repressive language are not the boycotters. The repressive language are the authors of the report that documented the silencing of the Jews. It does more than represent knowledge. It limits knowledge. And then he then she talks about the faux language of mindless media or false ethics. All of these are in the former president's language inflected against the Jew. We're in charge of the media. We believe in the law. All of it's an extraordinary rhetorical piece, and we're seeing it everywhere in the world. I always talk with you about Mamdani in New York. Same thing. There's just the rhetoric of hate in the most, it's Satan, it's Satan in a three-piece suit. It's Satan with dignity. It's Satan making these arguments that seem true.
And we've been saying this, you and I have been discussing this for a good part of maybe 2 years, about how so much of this war is a war on language, on emet, on truth. And it's the separation of meaning and words. And we see this, apartheid, genocide, Nazi, Holocaust, concentration camp, open air prison, everything anything that has had real meaning has been I don't know what the word is, but really plundered of meaning, and that's the environment that we live in, and we see this. What bothers me is when I have conversations with people maybe perhaps used to respect a lot less on the show, professors and experts on this who sit more on this side of this author, they have an inability to see it, and I find that strange. It would have been respectful, like respectable, if, for example, they had stood up for me when I was deplatformed, even though they hate what I'm saying. You know, it's that whole thing is I might disagree with what you're saying, but I'll fight to the death. I've destroyed that quote. But in order to allow you to say it. But we're no longer there. There's no more nobility when it comes to freedom of speech, is there? Or very little.
Nobility has been replaced, Howard, by cowardiceness. That's what it is. It's cowardly. And I am providing a kind of psychological, sociological explanation. It is much easier to take the lame perspective of passive protest and join in this silent moratorium than to stand up. And Howard, this is what you've been doing for, you know, also since October 7th. And I think this is what we do, is we reclaim our language. We have the courage, because we're not going to change Mamdani. But what we must do is we must maintain our belief in our own voices. And that takes courage. And I think we're at a moment, again, where our soldiers have fought, our soldiers are fighting, maybe they'll fight, where they're always fighting. They show courage. We have to show courage. And courage is manifested. It's shown in the belief that we have in our own tradition, our own language. And our own tradition doesn't just mean Talmud or Navi, the prophets. It means the world of Jewish culture that we are creating today. That's why we, yeah.
So Sorry, do you, do, no, no, that's, I get that. But do you think that we are being perhaps too passive? In other words, we are responding to the Mamdanis, but that is in order to get back to a point of, let's say, neutrality, instead of being much more proactive in our approach.
Howard, I agree. And, you know, everybody talks about, well, Mamdani's big failure. You know, he's not a city of international law. Mamdani did exactly what he wanted, and he succeeded. This is the BDS strategy. You succeed in failing. That clip of Netanyahu gets repeated again and again and again and again and again. That's success. He's just an agent of the Muslim Brotherhood. I hate to say that of Qatar, but that's what he is. And that's the message that's coming out. And you're right, Howard, we're not going to fight it. So we have the courage to create our own languages. And thank God we have long traditions of doing this. We're not going to strengthen ourselves, as you're saying, by pointing and saying, oh, he's lying. I mean, we have to do that. Somebody will do that. There are 10 NGOs who will do that. But what we're doing is we're saying, we are still here. We are still speaking. We were in the PEN America report as one of the exceptions. We've published Ed Writing on the Wall in our magazine, Balagan. We've published over 250 voices. It turns out that over 80% of Jewish voices compared to before October 7th, there's 80% less Jewish publication. And that's because of the phenomena that the PEN report documented. And you're fighting it. We're fighting it. It's a question of broadcasting. Our voices matter, not just as saying no to the liars, but as saying yes to who we are.
So what could we do differently? What could our listeners do differently? What's the practical way, at the end of this discussion, what is a practical way that they could get involved without being, without maybe needing to be an expert or a literary scholar, because a lot
or
of people...
Or an activist.
Yes.
But, you know, we bring the infinite, the divine into our lives. And just acknowledging that we do that, and we do that through our love of our tradition. How does that express itself? Through learning, through bringing up our kids, through... But also acknowledging that this framework that we have, maybe we've taken it for granted for too long. I know, Howard, you and I, we've talked about that a lot. We didn't know the tradition we inhabited. Now we do. We know we're part of this. And acknowledging it and captioning our lives with words like mitzvah or limud, these are important. These are ways we strengthen ourselves. We have voices. That's part of our consolation is... The Shir Chadash, Isaiah says, all flesh is grass. That's the Haftarah of Consolation coming up on Shabbat. All flesh is grass. And yet, we still have this relationship with God.
So final question is Mamdani, and we're just using him as an example.
Yeah.
We're talking about all sorts of things, but let's just use Mamdani as an example. He said he said the most outrageous thing. He listed every type of modern day blood libel. Everybody's horrified. Sylvia asking, why is he not challenged about it? He has been challenged, Sylvia, but. You know, in a way, I feel that we've done his job for him because we've all been outraged and we've retweeted it and we've, in fact, made it a bigger issue than it was. But it is a big one. He is a person of significant notoriety given his position. So we had no choice but to do it. At the end of the day, he wins because it's out there. He has these magnificent, powerful, because he is a good speaker, sound bites, and we rant and we rage against it, but it's now been said. And that's kind of how the needle gets moved slowly, mixing so many metaphors, but that's just what happens. He definitely wins this round. Is there anything else that we could do?
You know, you're right. I mean, he turned Bibi into Goebbels. Such a smart rhetorician that he knows, even though people will say, you know, he shouldn't have done it, he's mayor, it isn't really relevant to him, he doesn't have the power. But the comma is, but Bibi really, these things, I mean, that's how rhetoric works. And again, Howard, we strengthen ourselves against the rhetoric of the world. And we have to remember, Howard, we were once sitting in shtetls not very long time ago. And the nations of the world had the same hatred for us, and we were powerless. Now at least you have a radio station, Howard. You know, that's what we're doing. I have a nonprofit where we're publishing Jewish voices. That's what we're doing. So listen to Howard. We have a love issue coming up in Writing on the Wall. Right. Tell us what you love. Send in your submissions. Go to our website. Right, Tubav is coming up, right, Howard? What do you love?
Give us your website address.
writingonthewall.io.
So, I mean, literally, you're giving people, as we do, you're giving people a platform to write, to share their thoughts. Go ahead and do that, Professor Bill Kohlbrenner. Thank you, as always. Wishing you a fantastic weekend and a Shabbat Shalom.